In a world brimming with complexity, few creatures embody harmony like the honeybee. With tireless precision, she dances from bloom to bloom, each motion guided by millennia upon millennia of instinct, each act in service to the whole. And then there are the beekeepers, watchful stewards of this ancient symbiosis. Part agri-scientist, part poet, they move along their hives with the efficiency of Moe, Larry, and Curly, tending to the bees' needs as best they can comprehend, and with the infrequency of a waterfall in the Sahara, sometimes running off, flapping and flailing like a penguin on a hot sidewalk. This is their journey.
Welcome, welcome to Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by Man Lake. I recently attended the North American Honeybee Expo, and while there, had the pleasure of conducting a few interviews for this podcast. Just a quick heads up, these interviews were in a very busy, noisy expo hall with thousands of people milling around, so our audio and video quality may be a little bit below our regular standards, but I think you'll find the content well worth it, and we'll be back in the studio shortly. And speaking of the expo, huge thank yous to all the listeners who came up and introduced themselves. It was really fun meeting so many of you. So over the next few weeks, we'll be hearing from beekeepers with various backgrounds and beekeeping experiences, discussing new products, new methodologies, and of course, some fun stories. I hope you'll enjoy as we kick off today's episode with someone who really knows his stuff and has the PhD to prove it, Dr. Jason Graham. All right, we're back here at the North American Honeybee Expo. We've got Dr. Jason Graham with us today. Jason, how are you?
I'm excellent, Eric. How are you?
Fantastic.
Great. Yeah.
I say doctor. Is that medical? Is that PhD? What's it in?
PhD. And I go by Dr. J, or you know, I went to
get out of here.
Philadelphia area. So Dr. J was, you know, my I was a big fan of basketball, and I thought if I ever become a doctor, that's what I'd tell the kids. You know, you call me Dr. J. So,
can you slam it like Dr. J?
Yeah, I could try.
I mean, he was such an early pioneer in that kind of basketball. That was kind of fun. Yeah. So, some of these young people, if you don't know who Dr. J is, Julius Irving.
Yeah, look him up.
Okay, but we're here to talk about bees today, not NBA basketball. Yeah. So what is your PhD in?
It's in entomology and nematology. I earned the PhD at University of Florida. I got my master's there as well, but I went on for my PhD. And so I learned about all things insects and also nematodes, which are almost microscopic worms that live in the soil. And some are very beneficial and some are pests to our agriculture. So I kind of learned both realms there. But bees were my specialty. So when you're an entomologist, you almost pick a specialty, a different insect, or maybe a different aspect of entomology. Some are looking at pests and diseases. Others are looking medical entomology. I really got excited about beneficial insects. And of course, bees, I think, are the most beneficial. So that's always my focus.
So with you having a PhD, we're going to get into some really boring data today.
I'll try.
No, we're not. That never happens on this show. We try not. No, we want practical advice for beekeepers at all levels. Tell me about your beekeeping first.
Sure. So I first got into beekeeping actually at University of Delaware. I was looking for an easy science class. So it may sound strange now. I am a PhD, but at the time I was had been a high school dropout. Took about 10 years off. I worked lots of different jobs. And I was a little intimidated to go back to school. And I was looking for an easy science. I wasn't ready to dive into biochemistry or anything like that yet. But I saw a beekeeping class And so I wanted to try it out. And I met Dewey Caron there. He's a pretty famous beekeeping teacher and researcher and educator and great guy. And learning from him, and the first time I opened up the hive, I was hooked. I wanted to do beekeeping for life. And I think, yeah, that's a big part of it, is taking the PhD, the heavy science, and trying to share that with folks so it's not so intimidating and more interesting and relatable to them is a big part of what I tried to do.
What was it about them that made you fall in love immediately?
We had a lab portion of the class and also a lecture portion. So in the lecture portion, we learned all the book stuff, the biology of the bee. But he kept it very interesting. He's shared the life of the bee, even from a human perspective, what they were doing, how they were changing careers throughout their lifespan and different things like that that were relatable to me. He one day dressed up as a bee and came in and showed everyone. He demonstrated the waggle dance as a professor in a classroom full of, college students.
And what a great professor.
It's amazing. So I ended up his teacher assistant the following year. And I decided I was going to make my major. I was switched it from business, what I was thinking, to bee entomology. And I thought I was only going to go for my bachelor's, and ended up, I was talking to him and I was like, I'm going to get out and get a job. He said, why don't you stick in and, go for your master's and PhD? And kind of talked me into reaching out to Jamie Ellis at University of Florida. He was just getting his lab started up and was looking for new graduate students, and right timing. I went down and visited with Jamie. He drove me around the campus. We had lunch and talked, and he ended up bringing me on as a research assistant. That helped out with my school, payments, tuition, and whatnot. Yeah, I got some amazing experience working with him. We started the Master Beekeeping Program there in Florida. We started Bee College, which is a really successful other conference that happens, in spring now, summer, and multiple times a year in Florida. So I got to work with beekeepers that had been keeping bees longer than I had, but still being able to share new things with them and learn from them along the way. So yeah, I feel really blessed to have kind of fallen into the path that I have.
I like it. You mentioned the lifespan of bees.
Yes.
This is something we haven't talked a lot about on the show.
Okay.
Let's dig into that one.
Yeah.
Let's talk about first a little bit about what people call bee time or bee calendar or bee math.
Okay.
Let's talk about, and I don't want to get too scientific.
No, I do.
But the life cycle.
Right.
From the day an egg is laid,
right,
what happens and how long does it take?
Okay. So when after the egg is laid, then you have about 2-3 days while that egg turns into a very young larva that they're fed both royal jelly and also pollen and nectar. And for that 3 days, that egg, if it's a work, a female egg, so if it's been fertilized, then it's going to be a female. If it's unfertilized, it'll become a male and a drone bee. So the fertilized eggs, if it's a female larva, then it could potentially be a queen if there's, while it's still on royal jelly. When it gets, they turn it onto pollen and nectar after the third day, then it's going to end up being a worker and not a queen. It becomes a larva. It eats all of its royal jelly. Then it becomes the larva. It's fed the pollen and nectar mixture, gets older, goes into pupation. And when it emerges out as an adult bee for the first time, its first job is to go and clean its cell out. So it's that I do a lot of talks with elementary school students and families and things like that. And so I like to tell the kids, their first job is to clean their room, probably like, the kids' first job. So they clean their room, and then they clean their sister's rooms. They go around and start cleaning those. And then they're a just cleaner bee for a few days. Then they become a nurse bee, where they're feeding their sisters, and their glands develop differently. So they have the glands where they're able to actually feed their sisters royal jelly, the young larva. They can sense and smell when those larvae are hungry and go over and feed the hungry ones. It's pretty amazing. And then they get a little bit older and they start doing other tasks in the hive, other, chores, jobs. They move on to being wax maker bees, honey store bees. So as the foragers come in, they take that nectar and take it up to the nectary, and they fan their wings and turn it into honey. They cap wax, put the wax cappings on that to preserve it into honey. Some are processing the bee bread from pollen into bee bread. And most of the jobs kind of work from that center of the hive, the heart of the hive, the nursery. out towards the entrance. So eventually they become guard bees and they're spending a lot more time out on the porch. And that's when they're about 18 days old. So the 18-year-olds, the teenagers, they're getting new glands and they're actually able to defend the hive with alarm pheromone at that point. And they also are doing some orientation flights. And when they become foragers, that's kind of the elder bees, the about 21-day-olds. And they'll forage for the rest of their lives. So if you see a bee out on a flower, then it's one of the oldest bees in the hive, the elders that are going and getting resources for the other bees.
How about some of the other tasks, like the what we call the morticians?
Yeah.
They're cleaning out the dead bees. Yeah, the undertakers.
Right.
Do they all have a chance to do that at some point in their life, or are there some just assigned to that?
I think we're not 100% sure. And there's some flexibility there. So we're talking about the undertaker bees. And so they're very important for helping to clean the hive and get rid of the, you know, the dead decaying bees, some bees that may have, they're also healthcare bees that are going around to check inside the cells for bees that are, that have some type of a pathogen or illness. So they would take out those bees as well. And so this is helping to keep the hive healthy. And I'm not sure that all the bees do all of the tasks. The way that they can tell a lot of this information is they'll mark the bees with little stickers, different color codes, numbers, letters, and have them in observation hives where they're watching, you know, what's going on in the life of these bees and taking notes on, okay, we saw number 48A, you know, taking a dead bee out and things like that. And so I'm not sure that someone's watched every, you know, bee in a hive for their entire lifespan to make sure that this happens regularly, but there is a lot of flexibility. So if at one point they need more foragers, they could, you know, bring some of the guard bees faster, or if it, you know, they need more guards, some of the foragers may stay behind and guard. So much flexibility in the bee colony.
Here's what I don't get, and part of what really, really fascinates me. How do they make the decision on who's going to do what? Now, you would think that would be the queen's job. We know that's not realistic.
Right.
Is it just, do they somehow instinctively know there's a need there, I'm going to go do it? Or is there some boss in charge that's saying, you do that, you do that, you do that?
Well, a lot of it is very pheromone controlled. You know, they're getting a lot of their input through smells. So when nurse bees are looking for which bees to feed, they're smelling, you know, which bees are hungriest. When the guard bees are trying to see who they need to defend against, they're smelling for alarm pheromone. Queens produce queen pheromone, and this goes through the entire hive because bees pass nectar from each other, and along with that, they're also passing pheromones. So if you have a very big hive, that queen pheromone might not get around to all of the bees, but it does a pretty good job because of the way they pass the food along. So I think pheromones is one of the key things. It could be instincts, but this is one of the great mysteries of life, you know, that we're all trying to learn. How do the bees know what they're doing and making decisions? And I think a lot of it is they're just walking around looking for what needs to be done, or sensing what needs to be done and jumping in and doing it.
It's one of the things I love about honeybees is we don't know it all. We just see them make amazing decisions, work as this perfect community somehow. And we're like, as people, we haven't figured out how to do that yet.
Not even close.
Our government's all screwed up. Our elections are messed up and stuff. Yeah. And they have somehow figured out, although it's really good, but it's not perfect.
Right.
Let's talk about swarming for a second.
Sure.
I've read a bunch of Tom Seeley's stuff, including Honeybee Democracy. I've had him on the show. We've got a couple episodes with him. He's fantastic and just the nicest gentleman.
Yes.
I really like him a lot. But there still are a few missing pieces.
Sure. That's one of the exciting things for me too, is constantly learning, whether it's techniques in beekeeping or new equipment coming out that we're learning how to use, or older equipment we're finding out about, you know, that is coming out again. Nectar sources for bees, because when you get into beekeeping, you start to become a minor in botany because you're learning what flowers are nearby, when the blooms are. But yeah, there's so much to learn. It's amazing. Swarming is really interesting. It was the bees' natural instinct as a colony. So one of the things Jamie was teaching us, you know, when I was a graduate student, was you can also think of the the honeybee colony on the individual level, each worker, you know, going and doing its individual thing. But if you look at the hive itself, you could think of it as a super organism. This hive has its own circulatory system, its own nervous system, and its own immune system. It's defending against pathogens coming in almost on an individual level, individual organism level. Also has its reproductive system, and swarming is kind of the reproductive system of the hive. They want to get, their goal is to get as big as they can and then reproduce. So they send half their colony out somewhere else.
And somehow they know when it's time to do that.
Yeah.
They know how to get the queen prepared.
Yes.
Yeah. Will you tell us some of the things, some of what they do to get the queen prepared?
They, of course, have to start making the next queen, the next generation. So they pick out the worker that this, you know, the egg that they're going to turn into queen. They make some queen cells in preparation for the swarm. And then they'll chase the queen around and stop feeding her as much. The queen doesn't really eat the honey or pollen, I guess, on her own. She actually needs the attendant bees to follow her around and feed her and groom her. And so they kind of put her on a diet, stop feeding her so much, and keep her moving so that she loses some weight and is ready to fly. And yeah, it kind of stops that egg production for a little while. But it is fascinating, yeah.
It's hilarious. Okay, let's talk about drones for a second.
Sure.
And I just read something, and we may talk about it earlier, about how drones can't feed themselves.
Right.
Tell me how that works. Who feeds them? Why? When?
Right. So the worker bees will feed the drones, and the drones are voracious eaters. They're constantly hungry too. But they're not really contributing much to the food stores. You know, they're not foraging at all.
Zero.
Zero.
Okay. Yes. Not much. It's zero.
Not much.
It's zero. It's actually probably negative because of how much they eat too.
It may seem early, but right now is a great time to order your live bees for 2026 because they do sell out. And because Man Lake is offering a discount for Beloved Podcast listeners. Wait, what? I know, you're saying live bees, they never go on sale. Well, they are now. Click on over to Man Lake, order your bees, any variety, nukes or packages, and anything in the beginner essentials category. And when you check out, use the code GETSTARTEDINBEES, it's down in the show notes so you don't have to remember, for a discount on everything. So get your orders in early and save.
But the drones are very important because if the colony dies, if we lose the queen, what happens is the workers are now able to lay eggs, but they're laying unfertilized eggs because they never mated. So those unfertilized eggs will become drones. Those drones will end up flying out. And even if that hive crashes and totally dies, they were not able to make a new queen, the genetics from that hive are carried on by those drones to other hives in the colony. So yeah, it is still the survival of the fittest, and the mating really carries on those genes.
I call drones the teenage boys living in the basement.
Yeah, it is. It is very similar, yep.
They don't produce anything.
Right.
All they want to do is go out and mate.
Yep, yep.
And when they do, they just die.
Yeah, yep.
And if they don't mate, they also die.
Right. So they either, yeah, go out with a bang or not so much, fizzle out. So... But yeah,
that is a crazy thing.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned new equipment a minute ago. Tell me, I don't know how much you've walked around this expo yet, but what are some of the new things that you've seen over the last even couple of years to get you excited?
Sure. So actually, I was teaching folks in the Bay Area. I'm in Silicon Valley in California, and so I was just working with a nonprofit. We had sponsors like Google and Genentech. And so some of these, you know, high tech companies would have us come in and they would have their own hives on campus. And so the employees wanted to learn more and more about beekeeping. And one of them had asked if we could do a presentation on innovations in beekeeping. Some of the new innovations that I came across while doing research on this was Primal Bee, which is the company that I'm now with. And I could talk a little bit about that. BeeWise is another, I've worked with them. And so they're, I'll kind of scale into each of them a little bit more in detail, but there's a lot of new sensors that are going into hives, like Broodminder, which, you know, is looking at the temperature and humidity inside of hives, the number of bees coming in and out. We're just learning so much with the Internet of Things. The BeeWise is a large box that has multiple hives inside of it that uses AI and robotics to lift frames up, take pictures of what's going on inside the hive, identify the queen, look for pathogens. And that's pretty exciting, interesting thing.
I've had them on the show, by the way.
Great.
So if somebody wants to hear a whole episode with them, we'll try to remember to stick it in the show notes.
Great, absolutely.
So you can go back a little ways and see it. Yeah. It was fascinating.
Yeah, I've met the founder, gone into those hives and checked them out, and they're amazing. Did some work with them. I'm working with Primal Bee right now, and that's a thermodynamic hive. I'm looking at the insulation and the brood space. It has a triple deep frame in the bottom, so we're getting, you know, really large populations, and I think it's an incredible innovation. You've also had Primal Bee on the show.
We've had Alex on the show all the way from Italy. He was awesome and so fun, and actually one of our largest audiences. People loved Alex.
Alex is great, and the whole team is really great with Primal Bee. They're coming out with some amazing things, and folks should definitely check that out.
And I'm trying one of those hives myself right now.
Absolutely.
I think it's fascinating. I can't wait to see how the bees overwinter and over summer.
Yes.
Because a lot of insulation has got to make it easier on the bees also when it's hot. They're not expending as much energy trying to cool everything.
Yeah. So, I'm in California, so it's pretty mild there. We don't have to worry about snow where I'm at. We might get frost or freeze. But I do have a primal beehive right outside my kitchen, and I have a Langstroth wooden hive right next to it, and I keep an eye on both of them. I also have a top bar hive and a few other styles. But my primal beehive, I noticed in the heat wave when we had 104, 105 degree days for a week or two at a time, my Langstroth wooden hive out front would all the bees we outside try to ventilate and keep it cool and bearding up on the outside of the hive, whereas the primal beehive, it was still active, but they weren't hanging out on the front of the hive. They were comfortable inside. They got out earlier in the morning. They came back later at night because they didn't have to worry about keeping a lot of bees in or out, you know, in order to keep the hive at a comfortable temperature inside for the brood.
Tell me about thermodynamics. And one of the big questions that I have, because
sure.
I get differing opinions all the time. Welcome to beekeeping.
Right.
For example, in winter, do I need to get my hive as closed up as possible and have an entrance reducer where they can only get in something this big so that it's really warm, but also realizing what's going to happen? Moisture is going to build up inside, and so I worry about that.
Right, sure.
And then there's other people that tell me, no, air circulation is really important.
Uh-huh.
You can get too much moisture.
Sure.
Tell me what the heck you know about this.
Okay, so I don't have all the answers, but I'm still learning along the way. What I've learned so far that makes a lot of sense to me, the condensation will run down the sides of the walls a lot of times. Bees actually need a lot of water also during the wintertime, right? And it may be less accessible to them because they're not leaving the hive to go look for water if it's too cold outside. So they'll actually go to the sidewalls and pull some of that moisture off of the sidewalls. So it is important to have some condensation inside the hive so that your bees can stay hydrated. There's also, on the primal beehive, there's a screen bottom board, and there's a head space of about 4 inches or so between the bottom board and the bottom of the first frame. And this air, and the way that the shape of the inside of the hive is designed really for the, you know, keep the perfect humidity, perfect temperature in there for the brood. So the queen has a great nursery and, you know, the incubation is perfect for the bees. You could also wrap a hive with insulation, but it's going to be very difficult to get the same level of thermal efficiency with a jacket around the hive and different things like that. The material that we're working with is EPS, and it's an 80% density and very strong, and it's made specifically for this purpose, for insulation.
I'm just of the attitude of, let's look at bees where they came from.
Yes.
When they live in the wild, and I'm talking honeybees still, not native bees, because some of them nest in the ground and things like that. But your honeybees, they seek out hollow trees. This isn't just a Winnie the Pooh thing.
Right.
They seek out hollow trees. In fact, Dr. Tom Seeley was telling me about when he was doing some of his study, he actually cut down trees and then cut them open to see exactly how the bees were working inside.
Yes.
And I think as close to that natural environment as we can get, the better.
True.
That's nature.
Yes.
That's how they like it.
I agree, yeah.
I have a feeling that the boxes that we came up with over 150 years ago, and I'm not slamming on anything, it's very old technology, but is that the preferred place for a bee, or is it something more like inside a tree? And if it's more like inside a tree, what can we do to make whatever kind of bee setup we have a little bit more like that?
Right, so when you, I guess, look at what it, the trees are, and the same thing with even cutouts, we can look at what bees prefer to go to when they swarm. Sometimes they'll end up in the wall of someone's house. So we can look at what the bees are looking for, whether it's in natural materials or artificial materials. Some bees also go into caves or underground, you know, things like that. I had a friend, Anthony Valdo, who went from University of Florida, that actually went and studied with Tom Seeley for a bit before he went to Africa to see what different bees were doing there. So, you know, some were cave nesters and some were in trees. It seems they want a large space, you know, in order to start making their comb. They want to have a very small defendable entrance where they're keeping robbers from coming in, or pests, or, you know, thieves from coming in and stealing the honey. Yeah, they want to be able to control the environment inside their hive, so they're able to ventilate and, you know, take care of everything inside. I think the Primal Beehive, for me, it was the first that I saw that really kind of captured that pretty well with artificial materials, and had the ventilation, has the small entrances, has the large volume for the bees to build as much as they want. When we look at a cutout, you know, it's from a wall that bees have moved into someone's house, a lot of times they'll use as much space as they possibly can to have continuous brood. So the queen doesn't have to jump over one frame and onto another. She just has lots and lots of space to lay eggs, and the nurse bees, no obstacles for them to get around to be able to make sure all the bees are fed. Yeah, it does a great job at that.
We have so many options as beekeepers.
You do.
And I love experimenting.
Yes.
Some people just tell me how to do it and I'm just gonna go do it and make some honey.
Right.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
If that's what you're into, that's awesome. I like to try this new stuff. I haven't used top bar hives yet. I hear they're pretty difficult in our cold climate, but that's another thing that I want to do.
Yeah.
And that's fun. And
it
learn
is
how
fun.
To do it and experiment around.
Yeah.
So before I let you go, Jason, or Dr. J, sorry.
No, I'll be his yay.
I want to hear a wild and crazy beekeeping story. You've been around all kinds of things. What do you got?
Sure.
Or more than one.
Yeah, sure. So I really got into native bees as well. I can speak to that for a minute. So I was in Dr. Ellis's lab, Jamie Ellis, University of Florida, and it's a honeybee program. It's funded by both the state, you know, for honeybee research, and by beekeepers putting money into beekeeping research. And I loved the beekeeping aspect of it. I still do, you know, continue beekeeping. But I also was really interested in the diversity of bees. There's 20,000 different species of bees in the world. 20,000, you know, and the honeybee, Apis mellifera, is just one of them. There's a couple different Apis species, but there's so many more. So I wanted to learn more about bumblebees, and Jamie was very kind in letting me also explore these other bees as well, as long as I also tied it into honeybees in some way. So I looked at bumblebees, and I was interested in if small hive beetles went into bumblebee colonies, and if so, those small hive beetles could be reproducing in bumblebee colonies, and we could do everything we could to keep them out of honeybees, but they would come from the bumblebees back into the honeybee colony. So I really wanted to see if small hive beetles could live in bumblebee colonies. And so I would go out and put some stuff up on Craigslist, you know, back in the day. And I said, if anybody sees a bumblebee colony in your backyard, let me know and I'll come and remove it so that I can look into it to see if there's any small hive beetles. I got some commercial bumblebee colonies, and I put them out on blueberries for a season, and then I opened them up to see if there are small hive beetles in them. And to open them, I was actually working with the USDA. We had a lab inside the USDA building, and I brought aquatic bumblebees into the USDA building. And for those that don't know, honeybee workers are the only ones that have a sting that after they sting you once, they're done, right? They try to fly away, their stinger gets stuck in your skin, and they die. Well, not the case with bumblebees. They can sting you as many times as they want. They can, you know, put the stinger in, move somewhere else, put the stinger in. So anyway, I had the bumblebees open in a lab, and I had a piece of paper on the door that said, you know, bumblebees, live bumblebees inside, you know, please don't open the door. And I was opening 4 or 5 colonies. I was collecting all the bumblebees into one jar, all their pollen into another jar, all their honey into another jar, so I could test that, and looking for small hive beetles all the way along. And a couple bumblebees got into my bee suit inside this lab. They're loose. I got 20, 30 bumblebees flying around in the lab. I'm trying to catch them with butterfly net and forceps, and
Love it.
A couple get inside my suit, and I learned that lesson really, you know, quick, that they can sting as many times as they want. And yeah, it was painful, a different kind of painful than honeybee stings.
In what way? How does it feel different?
I guess honeybee felt more like a burn. A honeybee sting kind of feels like a match burn or something like that. This was, it was almost more like a sharp poke and then, yeah, like fire under your skin, but it didn't go away quite as quickly as honeybees did. And I had a different feel. There's different chemistry there. So I'm sure my body was fighting different types of chemicals and it was doing different things, but yeah, it was interesting. They also have an alarm pheromone, bumblebees. So, you know, they would have a different smell to them than honeybees did.
All right. If you could leave one tip or one piece of advice for everybody before we sign off.
Sure.
And I know that's hard to come up with just one, but what would that be?
I think one recommendation is to get to know the other bees in your area as well. And also the flowers, the flower sources that your bees have. Not everyone gets interested in just the flowers and things like that, but there's an app that's very helpful. So I've used field guides in the past to be able to tell what flower is which and when's it blooming and things like that. But there's an app called iNaturalist that's made by National Geographic and California Academy of Science. It's a free app. You can take a picture of any living thing, bees or flowers or fish or birds, and it'll identify it for you and link off to a Wikipedia type page that tells you their life cycle and all kinds of information about it. So I use that a lot of times if I'm trying to figure out what honeybees are on different flowers in my yard. I also use it for citizen science to figure out what the diversity of bees are in different areas. And so that's a great tool. And so I'd recommend that to folks. It's one that I've enjoyed along the way.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dr. J. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks again for joining us on Bee Love Beekeeping, presented by our great friends over at Man Lake. Hey, and don't forget to order your bees. And a shout out to Vita Bee Health for their support. Vita's Varroa Control range of products includes Apistan, Apigard, and now Varroxan, extended release oxalic acid strips. Thank you so much, guys. If you haven't yet, please subscribe and follow the show. Tell your friends about it and click on over to BeLoveBeekeeping.com to sign up for our free newsletter. If you have a guest suggestion or topic that you'd like discussed on the show, shoot me an email, Eric@BeLoveBeekeeping.com. And remember, if you're not just in it for the honey or the money, you're in it for the love. See you next week.